You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode featuring Chris Schweitzer and Scott Chandler.
They found me on a forest. I was flooding out of focus. And I was kicking it with Kevin. The scratches on my back, they formed into a choir. Belted out a chorus. There were clicks and hisses and complicated kisses. Gideon's got a pipe made from a Pringles can.
This is a fun one today. We have Chris Schweitzer, known for his Krogan's books and his latest version, Krogan's Loyalty, out from Oni Press, following the adventures of the Krogan family throughout time. They've got pirates, they've got Foreign Legion, and they've got now the Revolutionary War, and there's a whole lot more on the way. We also have Scott Chandler, who is known for the Northwest Passage from Oni as well, and his more recent book, Two Generals, and also his all-ages books, the Three Thieves series. These two guys are really wonderful graphic novelists, and it's been a fun conversation. We went over all sorts of stuff, so listen up and you'll definitely learn a little. There's some Make Comics, there's some biography, and there's just some talking comics in general. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan from iFanboy.com, and I'm here for another Talksplode podcast. I have two cartoonists slash graphic novelists slash whatever else they want to add in there with me tonight. I have Scott Chandler.
Now
you
hey
say,
there.
Hey. Now you say hello.
See?
And Chris Schweitzer.
Hi, Josh. Hi, Scott.
In the sort of tradition that I've developed here of doing sort of roundtable conversations with creators of different types, I thought it'd be really fun to get you two together because I didn't actually know that you knew each other, but I did know that you you've been mixed up with each other a lot. That's a thing.
Mixed up in what way exactly?
I think probably he means like every time there's an article pertaining to one of us, like it seems like the other one has done a press release around the same time, and so for like it seems like a baffling number of times news articles have related to two independent things that each one of us have done that are somehow thematically related. So
we do tend to get mentioned in the same breath a lot, Chris and I.
Well, I have one of those bugs on his computer where I can see what he's doing, and I just sort of do the same thing on mine. So that helps.
Excellent.
Viruses. No, wait, worms. I obviously you have nothing on your computer.
You can't even figure out a Skype avatar. let's get started. I like to sort of get the listeners acquainted with the general oeuvre and sort of where you came from. So, Chris, you've got a new book out, and it's the third in the Krogan's line. Why don't you tell me real briefly sort of what the book is?
Well, this one is a story about two brothers on opposite sides of the American War for Independence, and it's a little shy of 200 pages, and yeah, that's about it. Third book in the Krogan series. First one was Pirates. Second one was French Foreign Legion. So each one jumps around time periods and genres. It gives me a chance to basically never get bored.
But it's the same. You're doing the sort of one big ongoing story, though, right?
Yeah. It's all basically the same family line, and so that allows it to all stay within the same series framework, and you do have side characters popping up at various stages, whether either younger or older. So there is a bit of like a world building and a continuity there. But one of the things that I really try to do with it is make sure that each book is wholly independent, that there will be treats inside for readers of the series, but that each one could be basically picked up in any order, and you can use that as a starting point.
Cool. And Scott, I think it was a year or a little more ago, Two Generals came out for you, and you're working on the third of your trilogy also. Or is it not a trilogy, or is it ongoing? The Three Thieves.
There are going to be seven of those Three Thieves books. So I've got, I've got a lot of work ahead of me. I'm actually working on the fourth book now. The third one's in the can. It's going to come out in the fall. It's called The Captive Prince. The first book was Tower of Treasure, which won the Schuster Award up here in Canada for Best Comic for Kids last year. Thank you very much. So, yeah, it's a thing. It's keeping me busy for sure.
Now, you guys are...
Sorry to interrupt. Who's publishing Three Thieves?
It is published by a mass market book publisher called Kids Can Press. Really well known.
Okay. Yeah.
Really well known.
I knew it was one of the kids ones, but I couldn't remember which one.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
No problem. Let's get started and go back a little to Chris. How did you get started in comics? When did you decide that this is what you want to do and that you know this would be a big part of what you're doing? And you also teach. Am I right about that?
I do. Yeah, I teach comics. I'd always wanted to teach, and sort of knew that whatever field I got into, I was going to want to teach. I was young enough to not realize that was a sort of a wise, realistic move financially. It wasn't until after that started being, you know, a significant support system for the family that I was like, oh, that was a good idea. But initially it was just because my dad had been a college professor and I always wanted to do the same.
Well, had all those corduroy jackets around.
Yeah. Elbow patches all growing up. And so whenever I lighted on comics, which happened when I was 25, I was the graphic novel sections in bookstores had just blown up, and I had gotten to where I was becoming more of a habitual comics reader again. I had sort of become a very casual comics reader through most of high school and college, devouring newspaper strips, but really outside of that, not really reading all that much. And it wasn't until Barnes & Noble in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, just their graphic novel section exploded, and I started reading a ton and drawing more on my own and discovered stuff online, and it just got me really excited. And around the time I was 25, I sort of decided that's what I really wanted to do. It hit home in a way that it hadn't really before, that this is something that I wanted to do and something that I could do. And so whenever I made that decision, we just jumped into it whole hog. My wife and I moved to Atlanta. We moved to Kentucky first, where I taught for a little shy of a year in order to basically prepare a portfolio for grad school and start doing studies on my own and things like that. But then we moved to Atlanta. Excuse me. I started graduate school for the dual purpose of A, really wanting to own and learn my craft as much as possible, and B, get a terminal degree so that I would be able to teach that craft, and sort of basically just started from there. And in doing so, within the first year of grad school, I got my ONI contract. So Scott, you were one of the earlier people that I met in comics, actually. SPX, the one that I met you at, that was my first comic show that I'd ever gone to.
I think it was SPX 2006, unless I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Right. So
you just started school. Decide, what were you doing? What were you concentrating on, I guess, before comics? Was it just illustration or?
Well, I wasn't. I think concentrating would be a very sort of loose term for it. I was really all over the place. I had a ton of hobbies and no real focus. So I did a little bit of music. I did a little bit of writing. I did a little bit of drawing. I did a little bit of filmmaking. But none were directed, and I was not putting enough attention into any one area to really better myself in it. And I was at the time that I decided on comics, I was working at a hotel. My wife and I ran a hotel in Mississippi for a couple of years, and I just had a lot of free time up at the desk, and so I was reading a ton and drawing a lot, and it just sort of sprang from there. I'm really kind of lucky that comics presented itself as a solution. The two other potential career paths that I was actively considering were Episcopal priest or army. The priest thing, sort of, I decided that I was ill suited for the more pastoral roles of it. The preaching and the study and the theology I really enjoyed, but the idea of the one-to-one stuff, I don't think I'm necessarily as suited to that. now that I teach, I do that all the time. So I feel, you know, you make do. But and then the Army, we were seriously looking into that. And a big part of it was me sort of being youthful and stupid and wanting adventure. Once I found out that there was no way that I would be deployed anywhere interesting, that I'd basically be in Idaho making maps because I had a graphic design degree, that sort of killed that idea for me too. And I'm glad that it did, because I think that that would have been really very difficult for Liz. She was very supportive of me with whatever decision I was going to go with. But I think that had I been, you know, deployed overseas, that would have been very, very hard on her.
I've honestly never heard that origin story.
That is really something.
Scott, yeah, you got, can you beat that? You're like, well, I was going to be a rock climber or sail.
I should have gone first, because I was I was able to get into Congress.
I didn't do any of these things. I think that's important to know.
It could all be fake.
Still, I was able to get into comics without moving all over the South or considering the priesthood or the Army. So my story is going to be boring. I don't know. I came up in the 90s when there just weren't really a lot of opportunities going on in comics. The market was really depressed. You know, even a lot of real veterans were having trouble finding work. So like a lot of, I'm a little bit older than Chris, but you know, like a lot of people in my generation, I ended up sort of doing something else for a while. In my case, it was illustration. I built a pretty good career as an illustrator, you know, commercial illustration in the 90s when I was in my 20s. And that ended up being sort of the leverage I needed to get into comics. On my illustration website, just to kind of work out the comics itch, I started doing a daily web strip. This was, you know, 12 years ago, year 2000, you know, before everyone and their brother had a web strip.
That's pretty bleeding edge.
Yeah. So it was, me and about a dozen other guys doing web comics. And I didn't even do mine for very long. It was maybe only just a few months, but it was long enough to attract a bit of a readership, which included Jay Torres, who is, you know, I'm sure known to your audience, is a fairly well-known comics writer. He was reading my stuff and, we started communicating via email and stuff. He had a project that was probably going to go at Oni, which ended up being our first graphic novel we did together called Days Like This. After, you know, a decade of trying to get into comics and failing just as a fluke because of this webcomic I started doing, an opportunity came to me. Conveniently, the editor-in-chief at Oni in those days was Jamie Rich, who I had sent a bunch of samples to back when he was the submissions editor at Dark Horse. So he remembered me, and, you know, the deal ended up really being quite easy to put together. So Jay and I did that first book together. That worked really well. We did a second book together called Scandalous, which didn't sell very well and not a lot of people remember, but
I liked Scandalous. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, it's got a very small but diehard audience, that book. I still sell copies of it from time to time.
That's every comic book at this point.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. So and from there, you know, after I'd done a couple of books as an artist with Oni, I started feeling confident enough to pitch my own stuff, which is sort of what I always wanted to do. The first thing I pitched them was Northwest Passage. And I didn't know what I was doing at the time. I mean, it was this huge story with a dozen major characters and 300 pages long. And, you know, it was, for a first kick at the go as a writer artist. It was a hell of a project to tackle, but I tackled it and that turned out really well. I mean, it didn't make me a millionaire or anything, but it certainly got some attention, got me enough attention that I really haven't had to look for work since. People after that, especially in 2007, after the collected edition of Northwest Passage came out, a lot of people, called me up and said, so what would you like to do next? Which is sort of, I'm still digging my way out of the amount of work I talked myself into, in the summer of 2007.
That's what was your goal, I guess, originally when you said you were kicking around at the sides trying to break in for quite a while? What did you want to do? Because the style that I've seen out of you isn't necessarily a mainstream style, and I'd say that comics really only started opening up to different genres and styles, I guess, sort of at the beginning of the 2000s. So, you know, what was your sort of plan with that?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people growing up, I thought I was going to grow up and draw the X-Men or something. You know, because I wasn't able to break in right away, I never sort of got that Marvel and DC training of, you know, where you break in your early 20s and, you know, they sort of get out the whip and the chair and conform you to their styles. You know, I was off in commercial illustration developing my own style to a certain extent. So, yeah, I mean, by the time I thought I had missed it. I thought, you know, in the 90s when there was so little going on, I thought, you know, I'd come along at just the wrong time entirely. But like you say, when the early 2000s came along and the library market opened up and the chain bookstores opened up and the school markets opened up and the graphic novel format became such a big deal, suddenly it seemed like I'd come along at exactly the right time. Mm-hmm. You know, because by that point in my life, I mean, I was nearly 30 and I didn't want to go off and draw Spider-Man. I wanted to, you know, my hero's always been Will Eisner. I always thought, you know, his career path was, you know, in terms of owning your own stuff, doing, you know, really well-crafted story-driven material, you know, was the way to go. That's who I wanted to be. And fortunately the market, you know, has changed to allow me to be that, or at least as close to it as I can possibly get.
Cool. Now, Chris, I loathe to use this term, but it's a cartoony style.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is a bad thing. I just sometimes wish there was a better word for it. You both do.
I think the problem with that is that it covers so much.
Too much.
Sometimes when you think cartoony style, you think Garfield. But, you know, I also think Guy Davis has a really cartoony style. Yeah. You know, Jordi Brunet has a really cartoony style. I think there's a range of cartooniness. And I think it can be... I think it can go in two different ways. One, either the degree of expression to which the movement and the characters behave. The emotions are not necessarily realistic emotions. The movements are not necessarily realistic movements, but they are so evocative of the movements that they become more so than a more naturalistic depiction. And I think that's where like Brunet and Davis fall into play. And then slickness of line. And I think that both Scott and I sort of fall into that too.
Well, when you got started, I'm guessing it wasn't too much of a concern. You just, you know, I'm going to do my book and this is what it's going to look like. And that's a thing, as opposed to say, 5-10 years earlier than that, there would have been, I guess, a lot more concerns about with saleability of something like that. But were you thinking about it?
I wasn't really, that's one of the big reasons why I got so enthusiastic about comics, is that I had kind of thought of them as not really, I guess, being a possibility outside of the newspaper strips. I was, you know, one of those people who for some reason thought that, you know, 2006 is a good time to get into the newspaper game. So seeing basically all these graphic novels that showed that to a degree realistic approach to drawing was not a necessity. Especially Scott's work, like seeing Scott's work amongst some of the other Oni titles was one of the reasons why I approached Oni about the project. You know, they had a lot of these different sort of more genre leaning books. You know, they had romance stuff with 3 Days in Europe. They had, you know, crime noir with Union Station. They had westerns with Long Haul. But Scott's was the one that really seemed to be the type of, you know, very in a very similar vein to the type of stuff that I was wanting to do, and seeing that was out there sort of really helped give me the confidence to go ahead and do it, knowing that there was precedent. I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I think a lot of it stems from, I mean, Chris and I both, I mean, Chris is still publishing with Oni. I got my start with Oni, and I think a lot of it has to do with Oni. And like I say, just sort of the timing of, you know, the age I was when I began my career, nearly 30, where I, you know, I didn't necessarily want to, you know, be imitating anybody else. And also, you know, the time it was, I didn't really know. When Jay approached me with this project and said, you know, it might be published by Oni, I didn't really know who they were. They'd only been around for a couple of years at that point. And I'd sort of been out of comics as a reader and a creator. Like I said, I'd kind of given up at that point. So when we first started talking, Oni sent me around a package of some of the books they'd done. And I mean, they were all really great. But the one that really stood out for me was Andy Watson's Breakfast Afternoon.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I'd never seen Andy's stuff before, but you know, I'm sure you guys both know what I'm talking about. It mm-hmm. is so stripped down, mm-hmm. so unconventional.
But at the same time, it was so relatable. It was I remember being out of work when I read that, and I was just like, wow.
Yeah, it was a real revelation for me that you know, Oni was a company that was, you know, willing to go that far off the beaten track. And because it was my first book and I didn't know if I'd ever get a chance to do a second one, and I knew I had a publisher that was going to, you know, look like they would go with me wherever I wanted to take them. I just decided, you know, man, I'm going to do this book the way I want and, you know, everyone else be damned. And so that's the way I did it. I might not have done it that way with any other publisher. I might have been a bit more reserved and a little more concerned about what the reaction was going to be. But with Oni, you're encouraged to take chances, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Now you both, you know, neither of you guys went to school for doing comics, which is a thing you can do now.
No, I did.
Oh, you did?
I went to grad school for it. Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess you said by the time that you started going to grad school, you started doing the thing, you know, you'd started doing, the first Krogan's book.
Early on,
so
I should stress that, while the later half of grad school was really like, I guess, refining my style and refining the project and more than anything else, really learning how to teach. Sean Crystal was my mentor there. He does a lot of the art for mostly Deadpool these days. Just fantastic guy and really helped to put me on the teaching path. But early on, there was a lot that I had just sort of innately picked up and that I think I had a natural inclination for, but there were a lot of like technical things and page readability and composition that he taught me. And Nolan Woodard, taught me basically everything that I know digitally. He does up most of the coloring and a lot of the design stuff for Mark Waid's new stuff. Between the two of them, like, it really made a substantial impact early on. Now that impact was over the course of probably about 6 months. And after that, it was just refining, but it was hugely influential to me. It really was.
So that's where you sort of learned how to make comics, the storytelling, the mechanics of it. Scott, where did you pick it up? I mean, as you were just going along, you were teaching it and studying it yourself, or?
Yeah. This is another thing Chris and I have in common is I teach also, not to the extent that he does, but I teach a class in writing for graphic novels at Max the Mutt, a private animation college in Toronto. I actually took over. Well, I say I took over a class from Ty Templeton, but I actually sort of created my own class. You know, after he departed, I didn't really take over his class. But that's another thing we have in common right there. But in terms of my own education, you know, coming up 20 years ago, like you say, I mean, there was the Kubert School and that was about it. But I knew what I wanted to do. So I sort of put myself together an education in comics. I had a high school art teacher who really stressed life drawing, which was fantastic. That got me off on a really good start. I did a year of fine arts at university, then sort of decided, you know, painting and sculpting and stuff wasn't really for me. So I switched my major to film and got, you know, a lot of that visual storytelling theory that you get from studying film. Then after university, I did a year of animation at Sheridan College up here in Toronto, which is a really well-known animation school up here. And, you know, along the way, I also just took as much as I could in terms of, you know, English literature, English writing, acting, psychology, you know, anything anything I thought I was going to need. I think people probably, like my parents probably thought I was nuts, you know, but they probably thought I just couldn't concentrate on any one thing. But I was, you know, going along sort of acquiring the skills that I knew I was going to need to do comics.
You seem to be the most trained man in comics, I think.
Scott, that's a that I think a lot of people underestimate how helpful that sort of wider study net can be in college. I changed my major like six times, sort of similarly doing theater and doing film and then doing English and history and then eventually ending up with graphic design. But every single one of those informs what you do, you know. I mean,
it
really does. And I think that that's one of the things that, although I love being in a position where I'm able to help these kids, you know, who know what they want to do and are really focused in it and want to get as good as possible, I think that one of the negative sides of that focused study program is that there are far fewer opportunities to explore those alternative disciplines that will better your work down the road. I was freaked out. I was in the writing class and I found out that there's not a in the general curriculum, while they do have a lot of stuff, like they have to take, you know, like a social sciences class, like being, you know, psychology or sociology or something like that, and a number of things in that vein, they do not have a required I guess humanities/literature course. You know, they never read Chaucer, they never read, you know, the Harlem Renaissance, they never read anything that I bring up in class as examples, and then, you know, every once in a while I'll see a blank stare and I'm like, you guys have all read this, right? And right. You know, one kid, you know, the overachiever in high school raises her hand and like everybody else is, you know, the Tracy Flick, and everybody else is just, you know, sort of hanging their heads in shame, and that does kind of concern me. That is, I think, one of the only real negatives of the comics program for the eventual making of comics is that you don't have that freedom of exploration.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a lot of people over the years have asked me why I never went to art school. I mean, you know, with all the education I have, there's not an art school in there anywhere. And my answer was always just, you know, I know how to draw, you know, I don't know everything else, you know, and you've got to write about something, you know? You need to, you know, it's one thing to know how to write, but I mean, you know, so many comics are sort of, you know, rehashed versions of other comics. You know, you need to read stuff. You need to know things. You need to travel. You need to,
And it's like also not just for the sake of your own comics and your own development, although I think that's a big part of it. But I mean, every single editor is incredibly well read, and I have not met one who does not also expect you to be incredibly well read. Just from the standpoint of working, there is an expectation in the industry that you know, you are a well-rounded and well-read person unless you prove yourself otherwise, and you don't want to prove yourself otherwise. So I think that's an important part of things.
Comics needs more intellectuals I think and I think that's becoming true. I think it's gaining a lot of intellectuals, but
there's a book
the more the merrier.
I think it's going to blow your mind. That's coming out, I think, in October, Scott. It is the darkest, most horrible thing to read in the world, but it's also, I think, one of the best examples of comics as a mature and literary art form that I've ever seen. It's a book by this guy Chris Wright, who I met through mutual friends who had gone to school with him. And it's called Black Lung. It's coming out from Fantagraphics, but it's I think you're going to like it sort of for that same reason. It's this very like sort of Joseph Conrad, Cormac McCarthy type of thing, but with pirates.
Not, awesome.
it's the least fun pirate story that has ever been made, but it's incredible. And it's so nuanced, and there's all the symbolism in this non-literal drawing and lots of literal drawing and the mark making. It's just, but I think that it's one of those things that, you know, makes me feel like I'm, you know, I'm doing Baby Huey comics. But I do. I think you're seeing more and more of what you're saying of these sort of like intellectual approaches to things that aren't what we've had in the past. I think a lot of times what we've had in the past are, when we do have intellectual comics, they're so hung up on their own sort of idiosyncrasies that they become very inaccessible and also very sort of self-indulgent. And I think that we're on the cusp of starting to see more and more of these that are very narrative based and sort of divorced from the fact that they're doing something clever and just are clever by nature. And I'm excited about that.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time. So many people are so down on comics now, and I have no idea why. It's certainly the most exciting time I can remember in comics. I've heard someone talk about that black, but it might have been you talking about that Black Lung book when
it,
you were
it
here.
It might be to my knowledge, like I had asked him. I was citing it in a paper because I had seen some pages from it a while back. And I asked him if he would send me an image from it, and he sent me a PDF of the whole book that was just like, just pick whatever you want. I think my brother has read this at this point, so I think I got to be like the second person that read it. I assume everybody is Fantagraphics has read it now, but I felt very, very special getting to be one of the early readers of that one. So I don't know if at this point you would have heard of it from anybody else, but I imagine it's going to sort of sweep the the world soon.
Right, everyone will be hearing about it soon.
Actually, it's probably one of those, and I you know, don't want to say this to lash out the thing. It's probably one of those books that like 99% of people who read it are going to absolutely hate it. But I just really I really think it's incredible. It is a very difficult read, but I think it's a really worthwhile read.
Cool.
Chris, now you said you were reading and you just decided like, hey, I'm going to do this. I want to make comics. Was there a specific turning point, something you read where a light clicked on or even just a series of a couple of things that really inspired you?
It's a couple of things. I basically discovered a few web comics. Player versus Player was one of the first web comics that I had seen, as a result of doing like an image search for Indiana Jones at some point, and like an indie themed Player versus Player came up. And from there, I just, you know, would type in like webcomics. And I think it brought me to Webcomics Nation, or one of those little collectives that existed, you know, back in the mid 2000s when webcomic collectives were the thing. I found Raina Telgemeier's stuff, and she had on her website a number of very short stories, one of which I think was called Beginnings, and it was basically about her at age, you know, 8 or 9 reading the first volume of Barefoot Gin. And it was 3 pages, and it was an entire story, and that was something that I had not seen before. I know anybody who's, you know, really entrenched in comics, and especially indie comics, has read all sorts of anthologies where there are tons of 3-page comics and things like that. But this to me was entirely new. Like I knew you could do strips. I knew you could do, you know, graphic novels. It never occurred to me that you could do incredibly short stories. And make them engaging and make them exciting. I don't, you know, I haven't reread it in a while. I don't know how well it holds up. I think that a lot of Made in College autobiography doesn't age well, but I feel like it probably would if she still has it on her site. It's worth checking out.
And whatever happened to her, right? Where is she now?
But at the top of it, it said there was a little note that said this was published in one of my mini comics. And I thought, mini comics, you know, what's a mini comic? And immediately I knew what it was, having never seen one. I was like, it's something you print and on the front and back and fold and staple yourself and give out to people. And I was like, that's an insane idea. Like, I had never considered that. So I set out to do my own, and I drew it like that day.
Ironically, literally at the very end of the mini comic movement.
Yes, exactly. Mine was the last one. Sorry, guys. I did this one story, and I made it up, and I was really excited about it, and I showed it to my dad, And it wasn't, at this point, I hadn't really fixed on the idea of comics as a career. It was something that, or I had done it, but I approached it the same way I approached music and film and everything else, which is I'll make stuff, you know, without really all that much thought to it and put it out into the world, and somebody might see it and think it's fantastic and offer me tons of money to do more, which I don't think is really how the world works at all. I had shown it to my dad, and he told me, you know, he said something like, you know, this, you should do this professionally. And that was a huge, huge, huge thing for me, because it's not to say my parents haven't always been supportive. They've always been very supportive of me, but my dad is very much a realist, and more so when it comes to the arts. He's a music composer, and over the past 15 years has also become a mystery novelist. And now I think his novel money or novel income exceeds his composing income. He always did that. And, you know, so I always grew up seeing people working in the arts, both him and his friends, and also seeing that, you know, they put in 12-hour workdays. It wasn't ever, you know, done like a hobby. There wasn't ever that, oh, I have to wait for the muse to settle on my shoulders. He has always been on me. Like, you know, if I'd be out of college for literally like a minute and a half, spring break, Christmas, whatever else, if I didn't already have like two jobs lined up, he would just be all over me. And so, the idea that he thought this a viable career option, sort of opened it up to me in a way that it hadn't before. I never really clicked to me that this could be a real thing. And as soon as he said that, I was like, you know, this could be a real thing. And so I started like wholeheartedly looking into it, pursuing it, seeing what I needed to do to make it happen. So that was sort of the big catalyst for me, I guess.
How long were you kicking around the Krogan's books before you sort of had a deal with Oni? How many people did you go to?
I didn't go to anybody else. I had the family tree idea, I'd say probably a couple months before the comics thing sort of solidified in my head. And at the time, again, I there was the chance that I might do kids books or animation or who knows what. And so it was an idea as to something that I would like. And the idea that it would be a graphic novel series was one of many, but not really one that I actively developed. But it sort of was on hiatus until I went to that SPX where I met Scott, because that, you know, I went in specifically that my main people that I wanted to see at that show were Oni, were the Oni folks. Sean, who I earlier mentioned, you know, told me to keep an eye out for James. He said he looks like a big orange bear, so that he'd be easy to spot.
There he is.
Yeah, yeah. And so I went there. I wanted to keep my eyes peeled for him. I wanted to keep my eyes peeled for Scott. And sort of during that show, I picked up a ton of Oni books and looked through, and that sort of cemented what I already thought, which is that would be my ideal publisher. Not so much because they were necessarily doing the types of stories that I wanted to. I mean, like Scott, they had a historical adventure with Scott, but it was very specific historical adventure. I wanted to do, you know, who knows what, you know, I wanted to do like a Western and a spy and everything else. And one of the things that really cemented me to Oni is that not only did they do Scott's stuff, but they also did, you know, like I said, they also did Long Halt. They also did romances. They did horrors. They did like teen comedy. Like they were doing mainstream genres, mainstream from the point of the world, not so much mainstream from the point of comics. And that just made me feel like they were the right choice, that they had their head in the same place that I had my head. And so sort of at that show, James saw some sketches and I gave him that mini comic that I had mentioned, which later he told me that it was sort of on the, or he didn't tell me, he told one of my classes, and I was sitting in there and I was like, oh, well, there you go. But he told me that it was basically on the strength of that mini comic, what he liked about that mini comic, that he made the Krogan deal. So that was good. But the, But yeah, basically, you know, before the end of the show, he said, hey, you know, when you get home, send me something. And I got back to school and I was like, Sean, what does that mean? What does send me something mean? He's like, that means you have an invitation to pitch. So, or to send stuff. So send stuff that you think you would like. So I sent a Royal Tenenbaum's drawing, cause he had this Royal Tenenbaum sketchbook and the Krogan family tree. And that was it. Like no letter, no anything. I didn't know what I was doing.
Crumbled in an envelope here.
Yeah. Yeah. I put glitter in there, you know? Anyway, so I didn't hear anything for a few months, but at this point I decided that, you know, hell or high water, I wanted to do this Krogan stuff. So I started working on the pirate story, and then, you know, a few months later, I think it was in April of the following year, I got a call from James that just said, hey, okay, so we're thinking the pirate book first. And I was like, wait, huh? And like, you want to do this? And he's like, didn't anybody call you about that? And I was like, no. So apparently they had put up the family tree like in the office and were debating as to which book should go first and how it should be done and that sort of thing. Luckily, I think the family tree sort of explains my intent with the series itself, so I didn't necessarily have to include a pitch. But they had already decided to do it well before I actually sent a pitch or sample pages, which is good because my sample pages were awful. But yeah, like we were talking, and luckily they picked the one that I had already done like half of. And B, he was like, oh, well, just, you know, send in a pitch, send in, you know, story outline and some sample pages and that sort of thing. So, but they had already, I think, decided well before I ever sent in the pitch that they were going to do it. So, so that was sort of, I had done other comic things. Like I did a 300 page rhyming mini comic, in the meantime that I think definitely helped me work through some artistic stuff to where I was stronger by the time I got to Vengeance. I don't think I was good at all.
I got out 300 pages. Did you?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it was basically like, I don't think I really hit my stride artistically until about 2/3 through Vengeance. And then I think it starts feeling the way I wanted it to. And I'm still definitely not where I want to be. I'm still developing with each book, but I think that's where it's okay to stop being ashamed. Right. So I don't know. So yeah, so that's, so it just sort of came out of that. Like it was the Krogan stuff was the first real thing that I wanted to do. And I'm lucky in that it's something that I can see myself wanting to do forever.
Cool. That's a lot of certainty that I've never been able to have. Something. Scott, when you started off with Northwest Passage, you know, you said you didn't really know what you're doing. It was a big thing. I mean, how much did you have it planned, or how much were you flying by the seat of your pants? Cause it doesn't feel like you were flying by the seat of your pants to read it.
Well, my writing style is a real combination of planning and improvisation. You know, I outline to a certain extent, but I always leave a lot of room to discover things along the way. And it just kind of tends to work for me. I know people who outline really strictly, and I know people who don't outline at all. They just kind of start at page one and start writing. A mix works for me. And, you know, I've just kind of, that's the way I was on that first book, and that's basically the way I've been ever since. It was weird working on that, though, because I didn't know whether anyone was going to read it. You know, it wasn't until Chester Brown's Louis Riel graphic novel came out, I was about halfway through Northwest Passage when that came out. And suddenly I realized, oh, okay, like this is, I mean, it's a very different book from what my book ended up being. But, you know, History Comics had been the kiss of death for a long, I mean, when I first got into comics, if you were pitching someone a historical story, you know, you'd get laughed out of somebody's office, which is funny to think about now, 10 years later, when History Comics are kind of a thing, you know, because of Chester Brown and, you know, because of what I do and what Chris is doing. And so many people are doing that now that it's a genre in itself.
Gene Yang's doing one that I think is going to be really neat, but it won't be finished for like another, like, you know, who knows how many years. So we're safe for a while.
But it's, Yeah, it's. I mean, that was the real. Not only did it was it the first thing I was writing, and just in terms of technical, stuff, not really knowing what I was doing. I was just really not particularly confident that I was writing something anyone was going to want to read, other than myself. I was writing the ultimate comic for me to read, which I think is what you really should do anyway.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I think honestly, like I think everybody, like all the best stuff is that, you know, Bone is Jeff Smith's ideal comic, you know, Usagi is Stan Sakai's ideal comic. Like,
yeah.
I mean, like that's, I think that's the best thing to set out with. You know, I mean, every Krogan book that I do is what I'm interested in at the time. And it's what, if I weren't doing it, this would be the book that if I walked into a comic shop or bookstore, this would be my first choice. I try to make it that project.
There's so much cynical, contrived stuff out there that, you know, you got to, like we say, you got to just write the books you want to read.
Yep.
Well, it's interesting because you guys both have books that they don't feel, they're not dark, I guess, to a certain extent, you know, Scott, you get a World War II book and that was, you know, there's dark things about it, but they don't tend to feel heavy and depressing, I guess, is anything like that. So, is that just an aspect of your personality and the kind of stuff that you want to do? Or were you sort of, I want to do this kind of comic because there aren't enough of them or something like that? I can go to either of you, Scott.
It's probably just an extension of sort of who we are and again, the kind of books we want to read. I mean, you mentioned Two Generals. One of the number one things people want to walk up and tell me about Two Generals when, you know, I'm doing appearances and stuff is they're surprised how much humor there was in it. There's a couple of good laughs, you know, it's not a terribly long book and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, horrible stuff with, you know, limbs being blown off and stuff. But, you know, there are a couple of good laughs in it, which always take people by surprise. But that's, to me, with that book, I wanted to capture the entire range of the experience. I wanted to capture the, you know, entirety of it. And that's part of Men Under Pressure. You know, that's something that happens. I mean, war is nothing if not absurd. So that just naturally came out of, you know, my grandfather's diary and Jack's letters and all of the sources that informed the book.
Did you have more of a solidified plan for that book when you started it than say, you know, well, I guess what we were just talking about, but it feels like you would have, you put a little more, I guess, of planning into it, I guess?
If anything, the opposite.
Really?
Because it's nonfiction. I mean, I really went into it with the idea that, okay, I'm going to try to reconstruct my grandfather's wartime experiences as closely as I can without really knowing in any sort of detail what those experiences entailed. So there was no outline at first. Really, when you're doing nonfiction, the research dictates the content, you know. You're kind of constantly putting together an outline as new research surfaces. It was, if there was ever a book where I was flying by the seat of my pants, it's that one.
Now, did working on Two Generals, did that, I guess, bring you, I assume your grandfather has passed away?
Yes, he died in 1997.
Okay. So. Did this bring you closer to him, you know, in spirit? Did it change your memories of him? Did it alter your, I guess, what you would think of as your relationship with him?
Not particularly, I don't think. I mean, we were close. I grew up in the same town. I was 25 when he died. So, you know, we had a relationship as adults. If anything, it just gave me more respect for what he'd been through. I mean,
gotcha.
We kind of knew. Well, I mean, we in the family kind of knew the broad strokes of what he'd been through. But, you know, for 3 years at the desk, 80 or 90 hours a week working on that book, I had to go at least, you know, mentally some of the places where he had to go. And and it was a difficult 3 years. Nothing compared to fighting a war, of course, but it certainly gave me, you know, I spent a good long portion of my life putting myself in his shoes and nothing will make you respect someone like doing that.
Yeah.
At the end of it, you know, were you satisfied with what you got out of it? It's a big question.
I was glad when it was over. I mean, like I said, I had to go some pretty dark places, and it was. I mean, I thought that book was going to take me about a year and a half, like one of my normal books would. Like I said, it ended up taking 3 years, and you know, working awfully long hours, and I was exhausted mentally and physically, and you know, my wife was happy to have her husband back, and my kids were happy to have their father back, and it was a big relief when it was done. I mean, it was a huge weight that came off. I don't know. I don't know if I really have any perspective on it. Like, still a year and a half after it's come out, I don't know. I'm glad I did it, but like I say, I was happy when it was over.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, how long are you? I mean, you've got a bunch more Krogan books. We got to go through that whole family tree.
My thought is doing them till I'm dead. Honestly, like the thing with the Krogan stuff is that I from the very minute that the family tree started coming together, which just sort of it started coming together as the idea of the series started to formulate, really over the course of one day. And instantly I realized sort of what I had there logistically and how lucky I was. Cause you know, I if you think about like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, like basically, you know, enjoyed doing Sherlock Holmes and, you know, did Sherlock Holmes, but what he really wanted to do was these historical romance epics. And basically the public and the publishers clamoring for so much Sherlock Holmes put him to where he felt trapped by that character. And I know, you know, there are a lot of comic people that feel the same way. You know, they're trapped by their, you know, something that they work to get popular and then they want to do something else. And the thing about Krogan's is it's always something else. It's, while it's within the same framework, just my sensibilities and whatever else, you know, I can't, there's little to nothing that I cannot shoehorn into the framework of that series. You know, spy story, romance, you know, it doesn't matter. It fits into that. You know, if I've made this sort of biography sheet of all the characters, you know, where they are at different stages in their life. And so if I want to do like a teen spy buster or a boy detective or whatever else, like I have all of those worked in. And so basically, really, and because, you know, the characters do go over a certain age, I could do multiple books for each character if I wanted to, you know, at different ages and at different stages. And the only real concern is making sure that they are strikingly different from each other, that I don't end up being repetitious, that it doesn't fall into a formula or pattern. I think as long as I keep that at the forefront of my mind, it'll be fine. But really I hope to keep doing them until I either die or can't hold a pencil anymore. And I hope that the former comes before the latter, because I think the idea of not drawing is just terrifying to me. Although I do hope that's, you know, good 65 years from now. But yeah, you know, my, if I can finish 25 books before I die, that would be great.
Are you tied to, I mean, so I assume that you're comfortable with, and like staying in sort of the realm of quote unquote reality, you know, where your stories more or less take place in the real world. There's not a fantasy element.
They do. Yeah.
You know, and they're history based.
And as a general rule, the only fantasy and science fiction stuff that I really gravitate towards is the stuff that is pretty rooted. Mm-hmm. You know, like I enjoyed the Game of Thrones show so far because, you know, there's pretty much no fantasy elements. You know, I like it way more than I liked Lord of the Rings. I know there's dragons later and that sort of thing, but and maybe zombies or something.
There's a zombie right at the beginning. You forget yes, that.
I know, but on the whole, it's sort of, yeah, but no. that's the stuff that I tend to like. It's just, you know, the science fiction and fantasy is just not where my interests lie as much. I'm not adverse to them, and I'll enjoy a well-crafted one, but it's never been something that I felt compelled to write the way that I do the other genres. And so if I wanted to do something additional, you know, there are options for that. I'm currently writing a sort of He-Man-ish type of thing, right now that that somebody else is doing the art for. But in terms of books that I'm going to pursue wholeheartedly, you know, start to finish, me doing the writing, me doing the art, all of that, I feel like at this point probably it's just going to be Krogan's. I've toyed around with the idea of doing other stuff, and now as I get more entrenched in it, the more enthusiastic and the more passionate I get about it.
Now, Scott, you've sort of gone the other way. When you got to the end of Two Generals, you're doing this sort of The Three Thieves, sort of an all-ages fantasy, very big series of books to be committed to, actually. Was that just a reaction to you want to do something else that's fun?
Yeah, partly yes. I mean, one of the reasons I did Northwest Passage was that my first two books, Days Like This and Scandalous, were both set sort of mid-20th century, and I sort of didn't want to be the guy who drew comics about the 50s. Mm-hmm. So I,
which your style sort of lends itself to thinking that that could be the case.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, that, you know, that was a good, you know, introduction to the business for me. But I wanted to sort of break that pattern with my third book. So that's one of the reasons why I pitched something that was even more historical. You know, it was the 1750s. and then, you know, after that, obviously a lot of, you know, historical stuff. I went back to the 20th century with Two Generals. I love history, but I really wanted to, you know, not get painted in the corner of being, you know, that guy who does the history comics. And the other thing that happened was that I had two kids. And when I was a kid, I mean, I really have not generally as an adult been into fantasy stuff either, but I loved it when I was a kid. And I found once my kids got old enough to start reading, I really rediscovered what I liked about that kind of storytelling, you know, for that age. So I really wanted that. The whole reason the Three Thieves books came around is my older son, Miles, got the Fisher Price castle for Christmas.
Oh.
And he asked, "Daddy, can you write a story with a castle in it?" And because I'm an idiot, this turned into this seven book saga.
Yeah, I don't know if you were listening, but earlier Chris mentioned there's these 3-page stories that you can do.
Right. It doesn't seem to be the way I operate.
Yeah. All in.
No, I know. Basically, it's hard to refuse your kids, though. Penny, I got the new book in the mail, and like Penny was like, "What's that, Daddy?" And I was like, "It's a." My daughter's about 2.5, and I was like, it's a new book. I made it." And she's like, "Is it a dragon book?" And I said, "No, it's not a dragon book." So yeah, don't worry. I'm not going to do a fantasy thing now.
Krogan's Dragons coming up next.
Watch.
But I have thought about doing like a little kid, like picture book type of thing. That's like little girl dragon wrangler. But yeah, it would cap at like 24 pages.
Yeah, don't do 7 books.
Because Torres did one of those board books recently, right? For Oni.
Sure. I don't follow his career.
Well, basically, like I think they were doing that sort of to see how they go. So if it goes well, I may pitch that to them. So James, if you're listening. Little Girl Dragon Wrangler. It's a sure comic hit.
Nice.
It's right on the zeitgeist. I guess that wasn't sarcastic, but it sounded like it was. Sorry. Dragons really are in the zeitgeist.
I had no idea.
Game of Thrones is a big deal.
Sarcastic.
I have to do that a lot, where I'll say something and then have to go, "I'm not being sarcastic." We come from a generation where you have to explain that you're not being sarcastic.
I was being sarcastic when I said a surefire hit. I can't imagine anything selling less.
You're combining two genres that are big.
Hey, Dinosaur Train is the greatest idea that I've ever heard. I'm sold on those genre combos for little kids.
I've been sarcastic since the minute I sat down.
Yeah, I can't even. I've tried to get rid of it. Well into my 30s, I think I've almost been able to. I'm almost able to work without it. Even that sounded sarcastic. Real question. Now we've talked about, you guys have both worked heavily in history. I've worked in stuff that's been based in history, and I find that I like the idea of it ahead of time, and then I find myself getting bogged down really easily trying to make sure everything's right. Do you guys find that's a thing that happened? Scott, you were the first one to do it, I guess. Even your earlier books, if they were based in the '50s, but sort of getting those details right. How do you get around that problem or have it not hold you up?
Well, I like to get things as right as I can without getting in the way of storytelling, I guess is the way I like to put it. I mean, people make fun of me all the time because, I mean, in Northwest Passage, I mean, there's a lot of shots of the moon, and I sort of use the moon like a clock in that book, and I've got timed out. I mean, how long it takes them to travel down which river and, you know, what the moon phase would be. And it's a little obsessive, I'll grant you, but it's part of what makes books like this feel convincing. And there are lots of examples. I mean, Chris is going to know who I'm talking about. The beard guy. There's this particular blogger.
Oh yeah,
on the
beard
internet.
Guy. Oh
yeah,
gosh,
I've talked about.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah.
I've talked about
Bill,
this in,
something
in,
Bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've talked about this in other interviews because it's a good example of what I'm talking about. There's a guy who has a blog. He's basically like the historical beard cops, and it's like, you know, he wrote. I don't know. He wrote something lengthy about one of your books, Chris, about how the beards were all wrong. And he did a huge blog post about Northwest Passage, about the character of Charles Lord, who's, you know, he's an English gentleman, and how he would not in 1755 be wearing a beard, that would be out of fashion. And that's fine. You know, I'm sure he's right. I'm sure that's true. You know, I'm glad he's made.
Lord is badass. Like, he doesn't care about fashion.
Well, that's the thing.
That's my thought. Yeah.
This character, when you're designing a character, I mean, Charles Lord is supposed to look out of place in his waistcoat. He's supposed to look, he's an explorer who's been sort of forced into a desk job, and he's not supposed to look like, he's supposed to look like you put Grizzly Adams in a suit, you know? He's not supposed to look comfortable in that costume. You know, that's the whole idea. The fact that it's wrong is kind of the whole idea. And that's where, to me, storytelling trumps historical accuracy. You know, I will get things as right as I can to be as convincing as possible. But where there's a push and pull between, you know, storytelling and historical veracity, storytelling wins every time for me.
What I usually do in those particular instances, and I do like it when people point those out, because what I will do is I will stick by the storytelling gun or the design guns, and, you know, character will keep the beard or something like that. But I will deliberately draw attention to it in a way to disarm future arguments. So someone in the story will say, really, a beard? Come on, guy. It's not 1720. And he'll say, you know what? I like my beard. Shove off or whatever. Just to showcase that I am aware of the anachronism and am very quickly, casually, and dismissively exercising it from the reader's mind if they are aware of it, I guess. So I do that. It doesn't happen often, but every once in a while. Or if there's something that I know to be a widely, I guess, a wide public conception, you know, the Hessians being mercenaries, for example, in the new book is one. I will similarly draw attention to that. Somebody will mention the widespread public assumption, you know, contemporarily, and one of the characters can refute them and explain the actual situation, hopefully in a way that doesn't feel forced, but again, to dissuade people from being concern, because a lot of times what you get are people that, in addition to the people who know the real stuff and point that out, are the people who learn something erroneous in history class or on the History Channel or whatever else, and will be like, oh, well, actually, this is the case when it's not. And so if I'm aware of those conceptions, I do try to bring them forward so that I can refute them. But what you were talking about with the, Josh, with the making it, I guess, easier to work with, for me, it's all about doing the prep work ahead of time. I immerse myself in the period as much as possible. I read every book I can get my hands on. I both nonfiction and also fiction set during the period. I watch every movie set in or related to that period. Sorry, might have to sneeze here. Excuse me. Yep. Sorry. Allergy season down in the South. I'll you know, if I can visit historical sites or something like that, I will. And hopefully by the time I do this, I don't have to reference anything. I'm not having to check anything. I know enough about that period that I can just sit down and write a story comfortably without it ever having to click with anything, because I have enough of a sense of the period to know whether or not something is right innately. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And I found that that is a really, while it's definitely time heavy on the front end, you know, it takes about 6 or 8 months to do the research, which I try to do while I'm in the act of working on a future book, although usually it doesn't pan out like that. But then it really does make the following stuff move quickly and with the very minimal amount of headaches.
Do you script stuff ahead of time?
I have not outline up until this book. I outline very heavily. To me, very heavily is a 10 or 12 page outline for a 200 page book. I don't know if that's heavy across the board, but basically each scene, explaining what happens in that scene, what information is given, that sort of thing, just so that I don't leave anything out and can foreshadow and set things up. But I did I wrote a series of Krogan adventure radio dramas recently. There were 6 of them. And I was more pleased with the dialogue in those than I had been with anything else that I'd written. And I decided that it was because I had been concentrating solely on the dialogue. So with that in mind, I am actually, while I'm not doing any panel breakdowns or descriptions or anything in the script, I am scripting out all of the dialogue for the new book ahead of time to see if I can achieve that same degree of satisfaction with it. Which I haven't ever done before. And I think that's going to speed things up, because I usually do my dialogue as I'm thumbnailing a page the same day that I'm planning on penciling it. And that to me gets very frustrating, because I'll be stumped for a certain area trying to work it out, and the day will start to get past me and I'll end up very behind. So I think if I have the dialogue worked out, I'll be able to concentrate solely on the art, and hopefully it'll work out and it won't lose the spontaneity that the earlier ones had. So it's each book I approach entirely differently from how I've done it before, just to see what works and what doesn't. So I'm trying it this time for the first time.
Scott, do you sort of do it as you go? I mean, you kind of said that, but I'm sort of looking through one of your books right now, and at the dialogue, do you tend to put it in sort of after the fact or as you're going? Or?
No, I write. I actually write full script.
Oh, okay.
Which some people are surprised by. I mean, a lot of cartoonists don't. Kind of. Holy cow, Chris!
Sorry, I thought I turned away from the microphone.
No,
my bad.
Yeah. No, that's
bodily functions season. For right. For your lovely listeners.
Allergy season in the South.
Yeah.
The sorry. Where was I? Full script. I write full script. And. And here's why, is because, first of all, I mean, nice to be able to let an editor and a publisher know where you're going before you spend all that time doing all that drawing. Second of all, just for me personally, in terms of my own process, I really like to have a go where I'm just thinking about story, getting plot, structure, theme, character, dialogue, like Chris says, worked out, where I'm just thinking about those things and not how to interpret it visually yet. When I get down to interpreting it visually, I may make a bunch of changes. So, but I do like to have that first go through where, you know, it's just in a written form and I'm just thinking about story material.
So when you say full script, does that count breaking it into panels at all or not? Because
I will break it into panels just to help an editor visualize what I'm visualizing, but I'm by no means married to them when I start to draw.
I think that I'm running out of questions. So,
I did want to bring up if it's all right. While I was in Canada for the recording of those radio things, and Scott and I met up and did sort of a battlefield tour.
I was going to ask you. Actually, I was going to ask you about that. What is that, and how did it come about?
It was, I live about an hour and a half from Toronto. Chris, like he says, was in Toronto for a couple of days for these recording sessions. I think you really only had maybe 5 hours or so at the end of your last day, but I picked him up and we went on this whirlwind tour down the Niagara Peninsula of War of 1812 battle sites that...
Because I didn't know enough about War of 1812s, except of course that we won.
Yeah. So, yeah. So we had a little arm wrestle, you know, about that. Yeah.
He was like, "We burned the White House," and you were like,
"All of these."
Well, I think that they won in every possible sense of the word, except for New Orleans. After the fact, which I to be fair, I was aware of, but growing up, yeah, we are very much taught that we won the War of 1812.
Oh yeah,
which is foolishness. It was just the craziest thing. We did it so fast. Like I said, he only had a few hours at the end of his trip, but and I was sick as a dog. But
yeah, you were, weren't you?
Yeah, but we broke into a few places. It was cool because it's March in Canada. Not a lot is open. I mean, everyone's on their winter hours. Historic Fort George was just kind of open, so we just went in, but there was nobody there.
That was great. Like that was so much better than if anybody had been there. We just were able to walk around and look at all the armaments and the fortifications and just take a bunch of pictures. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was cool. There was a sign up across the gate saying no snowmobiles, which Chris thought that was the most Canadian thing he'd ever seen. So, you know, because we weren't on snowmobiles, we just went in. Well,
they trust you.
Just expect that in my mind, there's this expectation that they don't have to put up a no trespassing sign because they assume that everyone's on snowmobiles and that one automatically precludes the other. I was amazed at how I know that Canadians have a reputation for being polite and friendly, but Jiminy Christmas, like I practically expected people to break out into song while I was there. I mean, like the bus drivers would like have a great day, you know, like everybody was smiling, you know, like I mean it was
and you're not from an impolite area. I mean the South is fairly cordial.
You would think so, but not compared to Toronto.
Right.
Not by any stretch. Hamilton, they were a little gruffer in Hamilton, but well, Toronto, I'm like, yeah. it was like the Emerald City.
Yeah. But yeah, all of the historical nerdiness in comics was contained to my car for a few hours. It was pretty fun.
It was really neat. It was a lot of fun. We went to, you know, a cemetery and we went to what was purported to be a national something, like some sort of museum that was like a period tavern that was clearly not a period tavern and had been closed for like 6 years, but was still on the national registration or something. But yeah, we went to the fort. We went to the what's her name's house. Now
Laura Secord.
Secord. Yeah. Yeah. It was neat. It was there was a lot packed into that very short amount of time.
So are there any books coming out of that? Because you just did the Revolutionary War, so...
I will. Well, one of those characters is going to be in the War of 1812.
Nice.
Characters' sons will be in the War of 1812. Sorry.
We were both talking about on that road trip how it would have been a really good time to start a War of 1812 book about 2 years ago. This being the bicentennial and everything this year.
Yeah, there's the huge deal's been made out of it so far.
We'll do it in 2062.
That was sarcasm.
Right. See, but in Canada, it's like in Canada where the War of 1812 is like the thing. It's like our war. You can't get away from it.
Really?
And it's just going to keep going. Yeah, come up here.
We are barely aware of it.
That's because if we learn about it, we realize that we didn't win.
Yeah.
So we downplay that puppy. Yeah.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Come up here and you'll hear all you want about the War of 1812 right now. It's everywhere.
Wow. Yeah. I've learned something. That's good. It is the one American war that I know the least about, I think. I think if I was to look at them.
We went to the one of my favorite battles, which I cannot believe does not get used more in storytelling, is the Battle of Lundy's Lane. I took Chris to the Lundy's Lane battle site, which is in an old cemetery. It's a battle that took place in a cemetery in the fog at night. Just guys sticking with each other with bayonets in this cemetery at night. It's the coolest thing.
Yep.
That's terrifying.
Yep. And it's just a great location, wasn't it, Chris? With like that big old tree and like
it was fantastic, yeah, gorgeous. And I wrote down so many of the headstone names for character names because they were just so good. Like,
oh yeah, these great 17th and 18th century names on
the
every
best. Stone. Yeah, the best last name I saw there was Mizener. I'm like, that's golden. I stole that one.
What do you think it is that I know? I actually, when I read nonfiction, I'm constantly reading history. I find myself sort of reading World War II. I find myself reading, you know, Civil War and sort of around the wars and sort of, you know, I read presidential books. And I think one of the things that draws me to it is how, I guess you project yourself into it a little bit and think, God, could I have even survived then? Would I have even made it? And I know I wouldn't have because I would have had to have an appendectomy and I would have died. But I mean, what is the draw for you to sort of being attracted to that?
Soda made you have that appendectomy.
Yeah, okay, that's probably true.
Something like that. You would have been, yeah. Is your question sort of what is the broader appeal?
I'm curious because you're both clearly interested in reading history, which is, you know, in modern society coming to be a little bit of a rarity. You know, what's the draw for you? What is the thing? Have you always been sort of attracted to just stories of the past?
For me personally, it's two things. It's inspiration for stuff to write about. It's stories, right? As I'm fond of saying, the word story is right there in the word history. You know, it's just cool stories, cool characters, cool settings, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And also, more specifically, what interests me is social history. It's about how people lived. I was very clear, like, you know, when I was doing Two Generals, for instance, I was very clear that it wasn't really going to be a war book. You know, it doesn't have a lot of detailed information in it about how they took that town at the end. But it's more like what it was like for a person to live through it. When I was working on the book, I told people often that to me it would be largely the same book if my grandfather and his best friend had climbed Mount Everest and only one of them came home. You know, to me, the story arc was, you know, what the two of them went through. It wasn't the war specifically. I'm a guy and I like tanks and, you know, like World War II stuff. But, you know, what really interests me is as I say, the social history, the, you know, thinking about how different people lived in different time periods.
Yeah, I definitely, one of the things that I find the most fascinating, you know, I love all the action-y stuff and the sword fights and that sort of thing. But the thing that keeps me coming back, the thing that excites me are the parallels that when you realize that nothing has changed, mm-hmm. or at least let me refer, when you realize that that individuals have not changed, the world has changed. And I think as a rule for the better, I always argue with that with people who are like, you know, it's not the same place it used to be. I'm like, I know it's better, but human nature, you know, it's people have been complaining about, you know, kids wearing their clothes stupid and being disrespectful to their elders since there was one kid and one elder. Yes. You know, I mean, like there's just that sort of thing, you know, teenagers, you know, getting, you know, irritated with their parents and wanting to, you know, like whatever it might be. The human condition remains so universally consistent that it is a constant sort of, I guess, affirmation that to me that creates a very optimistic view of the future, that everything is going to be okay because we're still here and everybody's the same, you know, and that to me is always very exciting. And I know a lot of people read history with an entirely different and take the exact opposite away from it. But to me, that's one of the things that grabs me. Another thing is I guess I've never really thought about it at length, but I guess I'd call it the Star Wars connection. Like at some point when I was in like high school or college, I was watching probably, I don't know, like a Northwest Frontier India movie or something, and realized that everything in Star Wars is history. You know, the Tusken Raiders are like Pathan snipers, the or Pushtu snipers, I think is the more correct term these days. The you know, the Jedi or samurai, the X-wing pilots are, you know, Battle of the Bulge guy, or not Battle of the Bulge, Battle of Britain guys, you know, like whatever it might be. And if all of that fun stuff that's in Star Wars is all history, then anything's history. And that's and so any type of story that you would want to tell, looking at it from a storyteller's perspective, any type of story that you would want to tell can be told as a historical story, I think, for the most part.
Cool.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
So I guess before I sign off, do you have any questions for each other or anything that you've been wanting to talk about in terms of the work or you get that all out on your historical whirlwind trip?
I was going to say, I think we asked everything on our long drive.
Yeah. That was a lot of driving, but yeah, it was good. I don't know what I got nothing.
Oh, that's totally fine. I just wanted to make sure you had the chance.
You know, a quick break, discounting each other because of course we're each other's favorites. I guess are there other comics that are historically set that you consider personal favorites? Actually, that's a question for both of you, I would say.
I was just thinking of it. It's actually, have you ever read Alan's War? It's sort of similar.
I still have not. It's been sitting on my bookshelf for a very long time.
You know, I avoided Alan's War the entire time I was working on Two Generals because I just didn't want to be influenced by it. And I'm ashamed to say that I still have not gotten around to it.
Sorry, guy who wrote Alan's War.
Oh, he's French, so he won't know.
Yeah. Oh man, I don't know. Sorry in French. Wow.
Désolé.
I gotta say, it's not going back terribly far in history, just to the 30s and 40s. But I've always had a soft spot for Will Eisner, of course, is my hero. But The Dreamer by Will Eisner.
Yeah, that one's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's about the early days of the comics industry
Have the stand-in for Fox, like walking around with a cigar, like yelling at everybody, like
yeah
there's a lot of good stuff in that.
That is the first one that jumps into my mind, and I mean it wasn't really a historical thing for Eisner because he lived through it, but I guess it's historical for us.
One of the books that I really liked is sort of an off-kilter historical book. It was, I think, right when I was sort of going from reading mostly mainstream comics to sort of seeing what else was out there, was Stagger Lee by Derek McCullough and Shepard Hendricks.
Dang it, that is another one that I have bought and has been sitting on my shelf.
It's just, there's nothing like it. It's this exploration of this historical musical theme that I didn't know anything about, but is everywhere. Now that I know about it, I've seen it constantly. But that sort of goes through and explores all the myths, and you can't really know the truth of it in a way that comics can almost do better than anything, which for music is actually sort of impressive, but I don't, you know, it might be disjointed as a, like, how would you represent all that stuff, say, in a, you know, in a piece of film or, you know, something, you'd have to use animation. I would say, like, the first thing that really pushed me to say, you know, you can do something, you know, comics can be this kind of thing, you know, is From Hell, which is debatable how historically accurate it is, but it's a giant.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite comics, actually. Like I said, I don't know if it's good history, but it's great comics. Yeah.
I liked From Hell, and I'm sure that there is probably a nonfiction book from which it stems, the same way that, you know, Da Vinci Code is you know, blood cross, whatchamacallit. But there's it's either 7% solution, or it's one of those mid-70s Sherlock Holmes pastiches They made a movie of it. Christopher Plummer and James Mason are in it. It's from hell. It's the exact same story. And it came out and I was like, you know, it's already been fictionalized. And so I do wonder as to the necessity of From Hell's existence, for that specific reason.
It wraps so much of the history around the fiction that it's interesting. It's, I think at some point in the introduction, he says something about, you know, using the scalpel of fiction to dissect history something to that effect. And I think it's an interesting, I think that's an interesting description and as good a description as any of that book.
I'm not knocking it. I think it's a masterfully executed book. It wasn't until a few years later that I read that, and I read a bunch of those like 60s, 70s Sherlock Holmes stories, and then saw those movies, and I was like, it was shocking how similar they were.
The whole royal conspiracy thing around Jack the Ripper, isn't new. I mean, Alan Moore didn't create it, but he did. I think what's interesting about that book for me is he brings, you know, all of the information about Jack the Ripper, the fictional and the non-fictional, and combines them into one story and makes them work together.
Yeah.
The non-fiction elements that are brutally real help sell the stuff that's a little more fanciful.
Craft standpoint, like, he's using this combination of historical research, amateur historical research, really, but also like the language of mainstream comics, and with Eddie Campbell there, this sort of, you know, underground comics all at the same time in this giant work that, I think that was one of the first things that sort of blew me away in terms of just the scope of what a comic book can do.
You can't deny its ambition, certainly. Yeah.
No. Oh, no, and I don't deny it's excellent.
Oh, no.
I don't. That was one thing that...
I look at it like the movie JFK.
Yes.
Fascinating movie.
That's a very good, I think, good comparison.
Yeah, really entertaining. Yeah. And I do not have the capability or time to verify anything in it as truth. But as a tone, it's very good and very entertaining as just a thing.
I do not buy what that movie's selling for 1 minute, but it is a masterful collection of the arguments for conspiracy.
I couldn't even begin to hunt down what's true or not true about it. So I don't take that for truth. I take it as a movie, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, I took up. Scott, do you have other answers? I've been coming up with stuff.
You know, I'm going to think of, you know, a dozen good historical comics when we sign off, but honestly, nothing's coming to me right now.
Yeah, I'm staring at my wall of books, so it's cheating a little bit.
I'm glancing over my shoulder. Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck, the Don Rosa one, was really enjoyable. It's not, I think, what you would consider traditional history, but it's
well,
every single
talking ducks in it.
but it's great. I mean, like each one, he basically, you know, figured out that this biography of like the Barksian Uncle Scrooge, and like. Each one is like it's basically Uncle Scrooge's Forrest Gump in the 19th century, and it's each one sort of rigidly adheres to where people were at the time, and so it's a lot of fun. And I just started reading Enemy Ace for the first time, that big DC showcase thing, and the Kubert biplane fight scenes makes me both only want to and never want to draw biplane fight scenes. It's one of those like dual things where I know I'm not going to do it as good, but it's also like making me want to only draw that. And that I'm only like a third in, so I can hardly credit it as being a favorite, but it is pretty amazing.
Cool. Yeah.
It's probably a huge cliche to mention Art Spiegelman's Mouse, but, I have to say that, I mean, the specificity of it is so specific is what I really appreciate about that book. And I mean, when I was doing Two Generals and people found out, oh, it's about your grandfather. Oh, you're pulling an Art Spiegelman.
That's an annoying thing to say to you. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Really is. And I mean, obviously I wasn't trying to do that, but if there's anything that I did take from Mouse, it's just the to be really specific.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I think that's about all that I have, and this is really fun, guys.
Josh, thank you so much for having us on. I really appreciate it.
Very welcome.
Yeah, it's been great. Nice talking to you, fellas.
Scott, thank you again for sharing your spotlight with me.
Yeah. You know, come up again, and we'll go to some more battlefields.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye.
See you guys.
And that was one massive Talksplode, I think, that we could safely say. If you want to comment on this show, go to ifanboy.com, and you can check out this podcast and the comments there and all the other stuff we got going on at the website. Make sure to follow the links there to check out Chris and Scott's stuff and check out their books, both fabulous cartoonists. And if you've never seen their work or read any of their books, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Thanks to both of them for taking the time to talk with us, and we'll see you soon with more creator conversations and all sorts of podcast fun. Thanks very much. Bye. It was those two same kooks from that one stupid photo shoot. It was those two same kooks from that one stupid photo shoot. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing. You should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.